We've all been there, and it was a nightmare of monumental proportions, a time of nihilistic and existential dread, a period of fear and trembling and sickness unto death, or as it is better known, finishing high school and leaving for college. Sounds like the perfect time for episode 40 of Pop Art, the podcast where my guest chooses a movie from popular culture, and I'll select a film from the more art classic side of cinema with a connection to it. I am your Where Were You in 62 host, Howard Kasner. For my listeners, please like, follow, or comment. Today, I'm happy to welcome actor, voiceover artist Charlie Rossman, who has chosen the farcical coming-of-age Michael Cera Jonah Hill movie Superbad, and I have chosen George Lucas's instant classic, American Graffiti, both about characters having to make some life-changing decisions in their last year before college. Good times, good times. To begin, Charlie, why don't you tell our audience something about yourself?
I'm Charlie Rossman. I've worked as an actor for over 30 years. I've done everything from the stunt shows at Universal to the Commedia dell'arte performer at the LA Opera. I've been in over 300 films and television shows.
That sounds pretty impressive to me.
Thank you.
Well, with that, let's get to your selection, Superbad. Okay. First, some information about the film. Superbad is an American film released in 2007, written by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, and directed by Greg Mottola. It stars Jonah Hill, Michael Cera, Christopher Mintz-Plasse, Bill Hader, Seth Rogen, Emma Stone, Martha McIsaac, Joe Lo Truglio, Kevin Corrigan, Dave Franco, David Krumholtz, Martin Starr, Danny McBride, and, of course, Charlie Rossman. The basic premise revolves around three friends in their last few weeks of high school. Not part of the in crowd, they get invited to a party by a popular girl, a girl one of the group desperately wants to make his girlfriend. But they need to bring liquor, which sends the three of them on a night of farcical plot turns, soul searching, and a realization that their lives and their relationships are changing forever. Why did you choose this film?
Well, it's one of the more popular films that I've been in, and I think it's a very interesting little point in history. Thought it might incentivize you to get a nice companion piece, and it certainly did with American Graffiti.
Well, great. And as was mentioned before, you actually are in the film. You play the guard at the store where Jonah Hill is contemplating stealing liquor.
Right. And it has the famous catchphrase, "Don't do it, kid."
Right.
And evidently, they sold 400,000 or 500,000 ringtone with me saying, "Don't do it, kid," throughout the Midwest. I've come to understand.
Did you make any money off of that?
I think $1.50 probably.
Oh, my God. Well, $1.50 is $1.50, I guess.
Still go to Costco and eat. So that's a good deal.
So when did you first see it? Of course, I think we're going to have a little different of an answer than when people usually answer that. Did you see it when it first came out, or did you get to see it beforehand?
I saw it while it was being made, and then I also saw it at the theater back in 07 when it first came out. I was kind of excited to see it, and it was fun. My ex-wife and I went. It was interesting.
And what did you think upon seeing it?
When I first was making it and read the script, I thought to myself, this is going to have the world's shortest review. It's going to be super bad in the caption, and then the review is going to say, is.
Yes.
Superbad is. I thought that's how the whole thing would read. And yet, after I reread it and did my scenes, I thought, wow, this has a chance. And then when I saw it, it actually was touching and heartfelt, kind of invigorated the concept of men and boys being able to be open with each other, which I thought was a pretty cool idea at the time. The bromance idea.
Right. So when you first read it, you were a little uncertain about how well the movie was going to be received.
Yeah, it seemed really corny to me at the time, a little bit like a Roger Corman kind of film. That's how it read to me. And actually, that's the whole intention of the thing. If you'll notice, like the intro to the film, et cetera, it's very much like a Roger Corman piece when it starts. And yet the depth of what they were talking about and the fine way it was carried out was anything but a Roger Corman. So it was a nice contrast.
I saw it when it came out in the movie theaters.
Right.
And I wasn't sure what I was expecting, except that it was getting very good reviews.
Yes.
To be honest, I'm sometimes hesitant about films like this that are about teenagers that are coming of age.
Uh-huh.
Unless generally the reviews are more supportive, then I'm a bit more eager to see it.
Yes.
And I was really had a great time.
Yeah.
I think you're right. There is something about it such that it rises above a typical coming of age film.
Yes. Yeah.
For me, one of the things that struck me, and I think is the strongest aspect of the film, is the dialogue. which is unremittingly vulgar. When I said we have to be careful of our language,
right.
Because I put this up as family friendly, I'm also thinking we have to be very careful about quoting anything from the movie,
right.
Because it's going to be very hard to find anything that you can.
Yeah, I think I had one of the few clean lines in the movie. My dialogue, I think, was about the only kind of cleaned up part, and a couple people got killed in the process. So sex or violence, I guess you have to decide.
Right. And it's just a very enjoyable movie. It has a lot of energy. It has this great dialogue. And because of the dialogue, it has these very strong characters. Everybody works very well together, even though I understand that Jonah Hill did not like Christopher Mintz-Plasse.
Really? Probably too close in type, maybe.
The suggestion is he kept thinking that Mintz-Plasse was stealing the movie from him. and he didn't. But since the two characters don't like each other in the film, the fact that he didn't like him so much in real life, that just added to it.
Sometimes that kind of stuff, you can use it and it helps.
Right. But it was quite a surprise when I saw it. It was very refreshing in many ways.
I was very energized by it, too. And naughty as it was very hopeful in a way. And like with your choice of the American Graffiti, it's the melancholy nature of maturity.
Right. What are some of your favorite scenes?
It's going to sound weird, but it really wasn't so much about the scenes. But like you pointed out, it was more about the dialogue in each of the scenes that really carried it for me. Because there wasn't a whole lot that was really surprising scenically in the film. But you were surprised almost every time these two started to speak with each other. Michael Cera and Jonah Hill, the depth of what they were expressing and the honesty, as stupid as it was, I thought pure comedy.
I think one of the difficulties in choosing a favorite scene from the movie, and this happened on another film we talked about recently, Go, and then also with American Graffiti, is it's hard to pick out particular scenes. They all work so well. It's
hard to find
It's hard to find scenes that are necessarily more memorable than the others because they're all so memorable.
Yeah. I think, now you pressed me on the issue a little bit, I think it was the dialogue between the two of them when they're lying in bed next to each other, a few feet apart, revealing their deep feelings and their tenderness for each other. I thought that was kind of a leap forward.
Some of my favorite scenes, or at least I have two that I will mention. I do like the scene where Jonah Hill is thinking of stealing the liquor. One of the reasons why I like that scene so much is he has three different fantasies. It's not just one, it's three.
Uh-huh.
I thought that was just very clever.
And if it wouldn't have been well crafted, you would have been confused.
Right.
But it was well crafted, and it really was, like you say, a pleasure.
And then at the end, when the police ask McLovin, is there anything we can do for you? And his eyes go wide, and I knew what was going to happen next. And they're dragging him from the house, arresting him. I thought that was really very clever, very funny. I did think that the way the plot, it's built like a farce. And a farce is often defined as the very last person you expect or the very last person you want to come through the door is the one that always comes through the door.
Yes.
And this constantly happens in the movies. Always liked it when the Michael Cera character suddenly is out in front of the police car and gets hit. Yeah. Or the police show up at the party. I like those farcical elements.
I was mentioning earlier before we went on the air, a big fan of physical comedy. I've done a lot of falls and things in my life. I appreciated the physical comedy in that film. It wasn't like a main feature, but where it was done really well.
Right. Are you a fan of coming-of-age movies?
Not necessarily, but I've never thought of that in that way before, but I do like the concept. How about you?
Well, I couldn't say I am per se. I don't know how old you are. I'm 66. So I've gone through different stages of coming-of-age movies.
Sure.
When I was growing up, big coming-of-age movies are actually ones that people don't really watch now, and that's Summer of 42. Was really big.
Love that movie, yeah.
Right. Red Sky at Morning, Last Summer. Last Summer is still seen a lot. Then when I got into college and started getting into movies, that's when the John Hughes movies started coming out. And I'm not a big fan of the John Hughes movies because at the same time that the John Hughes movies were coming out, I was started to watch the classic coming-of-age films. And those are like from the 50s and early 60s. And that's Rebel Without a Cause, 400 Blows, and Murmur of the Heart, which in many ways are much closer to movies like Superbad. So John Hughes, he was big when I was going to movies, and people just loved his. I always found him too romanticized, too safe, too bland, too Norman Rockwell.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
I wasn't put off of coming-of-age film, but they, in many ways, had lost interest for me. And then they started making a comeback with movies like American Pie, which was surprisingly better than it had any right to be. And then you get movies like Superbad,
Right.
The Perks of Being a Wallflower, The Diary of a Teenage Girl, and everything changes for coming-of-age film.
Right.
They're far more interesting to me. They're much more edgy. They have an outlook on life that more matched what it was like for me growing up rather than the John Hughes movies.
This is a little off topic, but I'm kind of trying to make a point here, maybe. What did you think of the movie Animal House?
It's a ton of fun.
It's a great film, isn't it? In a way, it's a little bit later in the coming-of-age process where these sophomoric types are suddenly thrust into leadership positions, at least taking on the leadership or the power structure. And
John Belushi says, 7 years of college down the drain.
Yes, I know.
To me, he was the best thing in the movie.
I wrote an article about that one. I said he wove his way beerily through the film.
Yes.
I loved him from that point forward.
But that also, even though it is very funny and very raucous, and very vulgar, it's also much closer to the kinds of coming-of-age movies that we're seeing today.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, that and Revenge of the Nerds kind of an answer to the John Hughes
type
of movies.
The more ragged version of it, yeah.
Yeah. There are aspects of the movies that might be interesting to talk about. And this is an issue for, I think, almost all coming-of-age movies, with certain exceptions. And I think this is true here. It's a very straight white male perspective.
Okay.
There are females in this movie. They're not nearly as developed as the other characters.
Yes.
And they're really only there as conquests.
Yes.
For these characters. For me, almost the vast majority of coming of age movies are seen from that perspective.
Mm.
There aren't any minorities at this school or among their friends. It's a completely white school. And it does show, I think, a certain limitation to these films, perhaps.
Well, it's definitely true, both Superbad and American Graffiti. I think if you go through the cast, it's very much Weber's Bread. At the same time, the truths that are espoused in a certain way can be applied to different categories or people along the diversity spectrum. But yeah, it wasn't written with them involved, that's for sure.
Right. The females in the movies, even in American Graffiti as well, aren't given the same perspective or the same depth. They're not looked at as quite the same way.
I would make one exception with American Graffiti. I thought the Cindy Williams character, Ron Howard's girlfriend, like when she tells him to go to hell, et cetera, when they're on the dance floor, I think she had moments of what she was going through and experiencing, but it was more in reaction to what he was choosing to do as opposed to what she was choosing to do.
Yes, I do think that the women in American Graffiti do get a little bit more time, have more depth as well. And in American Graffiti, if you notice, you'll blink and you'll miss it, there is one black couple at the school.
Oh, okay.
You go to the dance and there's one black couple.
Yeah.
Which was probably very accurate for Modesto, California.
Demographically, that was probably a good casting decision.
I guess it was accurate.
Yeah.
Probably. I mean, I don't know. I didn't go to Modesto, California. But I knew that when I grew up, I would hit high school about 6 years after 62, around 68.
Yes.
There were very few black students at my high school as well. So it was a product of time.
What do they call that? Redlining? Or
it was. Are you a fan of the Seth Rogen type movies?
Not necessarily. He's always been very generous with me, and his partner Evan Goldberg have always been very nice to me, and I volleyed a few ideas to them over the years about some ideas I had for a roller derby and some other things that I had ideas for. I had an early concept similar to Glow, the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling. They've always been very generous with their time and hearing out my ideas. I haven't sold them anything necessarily, but as far as that actual type of dialogue, not necessarily a super bad style of dialogue, but in some of the other films, that's not necessarily my forte. I watch them, but they're not necessarily my favorites. How about you?
I find them often a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
I do find them hit and miss. I do find their attitude toward women is often problematic. In Knocked Up, for example, I think women are treated horribly in that movie. And I never understood why the central female character started a relationship with Seth Rogen. I could understand why she told him about the baby and said, if you want to be a part of the baby's life, that's fine. But why would she ever move in or start a relationship with this loser? Never made any sense to me. And then the other woman was just this awful, awful harridan of a wife.
Yes. Maybe Judd Apatow was reflecting some of his biases there. I don't know.
You may have a point there that this may be more Judd Apatow than Seth Rogen. Things like Pineapple Express were a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. I did think Seth Rogen has become a better actor over the years. I liked him very much in 50-50.
Yes. The director of Superbad, a lot of people gloss over this. I mean, it's always mentioned, but it's never really paid attention to. It was a gentleman by the name of Gregory Mottola, kind of an interesting man, very understated and very quiet, very simple in his direction. He did a really nice job on Superbad and brought some of the vulgarity and put it in context. He hasn't gotten nearly the credit he might have.
I do think that he has made some other other excellent movies. I liked Adventureland very much. And Day Trippers, I thought, was an underrated film. I mean, I can't say underrated. I think the critics liked it, but it didn't get a lot of attention at the time. So I do think that, yes, definitely. I think he started maybe having some issues when he did Paul, which was a not quite a legendary flop, but the critics certainly didn't care for it very much.
No. You take a few blows to the broadside and suddenly you're sinking as opposed to floating.
But I do think you have a point. He does get overshadowed by everybody talking about the dialogue and the screenplay.
Right.
And being a screenwriter, I'm sort of saying, well, okay, that's fine with me. But it doesn't happen very often. It doesn't happen where the dialogue and the screenwriters are the one given the most credit for the success of the movie.
I'm not a super nuanced performer necessarily. I like the broad and, I'll hump your leg if it's funny kind of occasionally as well. But I think the way that he served this project in his gentleness and his approach, I think really helped it actually.
Well, certainly he kept it grounded.
Yes. If you read the scripts, I'm sure you have, of that specific film, it reads a little crass, but like we've been discussing, he made it much more real.
Yeah, it's probably a combination of that and getting the right actors.
Yeah, you know, that's a hell of a cast in both American Graffiti and Superbad. Even in some of, like, a lot of the smaller parts, there's some very talented people.
It is one of those. Well, it's still too recent a film to really say this.
Yeah.
And we'll get more into that in American Graffiti. But it does have this cast that became really big.
Yeah.
Jonah Hill has 2 Oscar nominations. I never thought that he would be considered a good actor. I thought he had this thing he did, and it was really good what he did. I never expected him to become a really excellent actor, and suddenly he is. And Michael Cera became big. Emma Stone has won an Oscar for Best Actor. These people have just gone to be really, really big.
Phil Hader, what was that Netflix series he had?
It's an HBO series.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Barry, he's an acting student slash assassin.
I haven't seen that whole series, but I saw several of them, and that's a fun one, too.
Another aspect I wanted to address was the ending. And this was actually brought up at the time when it was released. And that was the Jonah Hill getting together with Emma Stone.
Yeah.
And a lot of people said that simply wasn't believable. How did you react?
I didn't think it was believable. I agree 100%. I didn't get that part, but it didn't ruin the movie for me, but I didn't believe it.
Yes, I didn't believe it either. I think she's way out of his league.
Yeah.
I don't think she'd be interested in him. But I heard, or I read, and I can't confirm this, that they chose this ending more for box office reasons. They didn't want any downer at that part.
Yeah.
But in real life, Michael Cera, his character, would go off with this girl he's interested in and who was interested in him. And Jonah Hill would have gone off alone, which is another one of the things that will differentiate them and set them off on their different tracks.
Yeah. It sound kind of judgmental, but their characters both were charming in their own individual ways, but the type of charm that Jonah Hill was exhibiting necessarily didn't lead to that kind of a relationship for his character.
That, and to be perfectly honest, he's just not the physical type that a character like Emma Stone, especially in high school, would probably be involved in.
It was written by Seth and Evan. His characters are kind of modeled on them. So maybe it was partially a little bit of a pat on the back to themselves or something.
Probably so. Yes, a large part of it was autobiographical or based on things that really happened, how they would have liked things to have turned out.
Yes.
How long did you work on the film?
Just a few days.
Yeah.
Like probably 3-4 days total.
What was it like working on it?
Very easy. It was a well-budgeted film, so it treated everyone very nice. Greg Mottola is a very nice director. He had some brief discussions, and he would let me try different ways. Actually, it was a lot of fun. And at the wrap party, there was a scene in the movie where I had to catch a bottle that was thrown to me.
Right.
And, we did maybe 15 takes on that, and I caught the bottle every single time at all kinds of different angles. And at the wrap party, they edited together the 15 takes of me catching the bottle with one hand from all these different angles. It was fun that these celebrities gave me my moments too.
Oh,
you know? They're very generous. Yeah.
What was it like working with Jonah Hill?
At the time, he was very much an unknown, kind of an acerbic kid, but we had some differences of opinion as to how the neck slash would go and things like that, and how the blood pump would be put on, and we had different conversations about that, and I had a different opinion on it than he did. I'd have to say that we ended up doing it both ways, so that was nice. We had a couple days of looping, and very generous, nice guy, easy to work with. I'm surprised at the breadth of roles he's getting, but not that he's getting work, but that they've allowed him a lot of different characters. I think he's done pretty well overall.
What about the older woman that was in the scene?
Actually, I did most of the interaction with her stunt double that was a man.
Oh.
She's very nice, though. Very pleasant. Nothing that really stands out in my mind too much other than easy to work with. And in the back of my mind, snicker, though, when I realize it's the man taking the hit.
Do people ever recognize you?
Yeah, in 07 and 08, when the film was, it's still very popular, but my kids were in high school. It was very big in the high school crowds. And I coached both of my son's teams. So the kids all gave me that goo-goo look a little bit. In my hometown, in around Orange County, around where I was at for a few years, I was the guy.
What did your kids think of the film?
Well, they liked the film and their friends really liked it. And I think it gave them a little cachet. So I think that overall, that's been a good experience for them. Like I say, I've done over 300 films and television shows, and I swing up in a lot of places. I think I'm at a nice level of notoriety, I guess you'd say. You know, people know my work, but it's not like a burden.
Right. You know? Did you say that you also write?
I do. I write a lot of sketches. One of the reasons I'm hired is that they like my improvisation. So I'm generally given a few takes of the writing and given a few takes of the improvisation. And generally the scriptwriter stuff, and rightfully so, ends up in the movie or in the script, but in the finished product. But occasionally my stuff jumps in there too. And I've been doing a lot in the animation field lately. My friend Jim Lujan is the primary writer and creator of Jim Lujan Animation. And he has several features that have come out in the past few years. And I get to do many of the voices in those projects. Occasionally he'll give me a direction, kind of the way that when I worked on Curb Your Enthusiasm, it's the same kind of way that we work, which is, here's what the script's trying to accomplish in this scene. You walk in and you find the money from the funeral home, etc. And then Larry says this. And then you improvise it out three or four times and they take the best lines and that's what you shoot. That's kind of the way I write. In fact, the way they shoot Curb Your Enthusiasm, that's how they work it. They just have basic scene descriptions and then you flesh that out.
With that, here's some more information about the movie. It cost $20 million to make, and it made $170.8 million. So I guess you would call it a hit.
Yeah, eight or nine times, sure.
The high school is actually the exterior of El Segunda High School.
Yep.
And the mall scenes were shot at the Fox Hills Mall, which is now the Westfield Culver City Mall.
Right.
Mintz Plasse was only 17 at the time of filming, and because of this, his mother was required to be present on set during his sex scene. I think he and Michael Cera were the only teenagers. Michael Cera, I think, was 18.
Right.
And Jonah Hill, I think, was 23.
Yes.
Originally, I guess Seth Hill was considering playing the Jonah Hill part, but he looked just a little too old. And this was the film debut of both Emma Stone and Christopher Mintz Plasse.
You were talking about location. Just came to mind that parts of American Graffiti were shot in my hometown along Citrus Boulevard in Covina.
Yes, they filmed it in a few locations. They had sort of trouble at one location because they got tired of them being there and causing problems. So they had to move to another town and finishing up. And they even filmed in San Francisco because I guess Mel Steiner in San Francisco. Well, with that, that's a good segue. Let's get to my selection, and that is American Graffiti. First, some information about the film. American Graffiti is a 1973 American film written by George Lucas, Gloria Katz, and Willard Hook, and directed by Lucas. It stars Richard Dreyfuss, Ron Howard, Paul LaMatte, Charles Martin Smith, Cindy Williams, Candy Clark, Mackenzie Phillips, Wolfman Jack, Bo Hopkins, Harrison Ford, Kathleen Quinlan, K.A. Kemper, Joe Spano, and Suzanne Summers. The story dramatizes the last night of summer, where a group of recent high school graduates spend their time cruising the streets of their small town. During the night, they try to pick up girls, buy liquor, have sex, and a drag race, while two best friends have to decide whether to leave for college the next day. So what do you think of the pairing of the two films?
When I saw that you did that, I thought, this guy's he's a pretty smart cookie. I loved your choice, actually.
When did you first see the film?
I can't remember when I first saw it. I know I've seen it on multiple occasions. Being a child of the 70s, I'd make this comparison. Superbad, it was for many of the kids in my son's age, it kind of was their film, their generational film. And for me in the 70s, I thought American Graffiti, even though it was taking place in the 60s, and it was portraying my parents' generation, it really spoke to my generation. And we brought up Animal House a minute ago, too. That played a lot to the kids in the late 70s and 80s, their kind of generational film in a way.
What did you think of the film when you first saw it? What were your impressions?
I loved it. I thought it was so many charming people, just one after the other. You went to the cast list and all of those people are incredibly charming people. And great casting, great dialogue, fun, colorful, a lot of action, a lot of silliness. It was a great film, just great.
I first saw it when it came out. I was in college. I do remember it was in college because I went to see it with some friends. And you're right, it's immediately likable.
Right.
You just get immediately sucked in. When it starts with Rock Around the Clock, That just really brings you in, and it tells you that this is going to be a nostalgic blast from the past. And I loved it, and I identified with a lot of the characters about going to college, even though I was in college at the time. I didn't come from that small a town, but I came from Corpus Christi, Texas. I often call it the most boring city on the face of the earth, and was so happy to get out of it. In many ways, identified with the Richard Dreyfuss character.
Okay.
But you are right. It looks great. It's a beautifully shot film, and it has a wonderful screenplay. In fact, one might say that that is one of the things that sort of has in common with Superbad. It's a film that you more remember for the screenplay in some ways than you do for the direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The understanding, though, of all of the different subcultures, the gangs and the drag racers, and none of them were really discarded or felt to be less. It was all these different groups. The dance that they did was very, very well written.
Yes. When they do the dance, they don't actually do a snowball dance.
Oh, okay.
Snowball dance, you start dancing with someone, and then after a moment, you dance with different partners.
Right.
And then after a moment, you dance with different partners. So you start with two, and then you get another two, and then you get four, and then you get eight, and then you get 16. Oh. Then everybody else gets involved like a snowball rolling down the side. But
avalanche. I didn't know that.
I did not either. I had to read this. So they're supposed to break apart and go to other partners, but they don't. And so nobody else and the sock hop got to dance because they never switched partners.
Yeah.
That is a good scene. And then they had the scene where they line up on both sides and everybody has to dance down the middle.
Oh, yeah. Like the Soul Train dance.
Right. This is one of these films, again, that it's a screenplay that really stands out, that people really remember. What are some of your favorite scenes from the movie?
I like all of the Paul LaMatt stuff with Mackenzie Phillips.
Yes.
That one line that she says to him, if I had a boyfriend, he'd pound you or something like that. just a genius line, you know?
Yes. Is this what cupping feel is?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of understanding of what people might have actually said, you know?
But yes, the Paul LaMatt in his yellow...
Deuce Coupe or something like
Deuce
that?
Deuce Coupe, yeah. One of my favorites is buying the liquor, where first he gets the drunk old guy who then takes his money and goes out the back.
Yeah.
And then another guy offers to buy it and he leaves. Yeah. he's robbed the place and tosses the liquor.
Yeah.
Which resembles in some ways the scene in Superbad where he's buying the liquor and then the thief comes in, knocks him down and steals the money.
Yeah. It's very similar, isn't it?
But there are a lot of similar scenes. A lot of similar things do happen in both of them. The nerd, which is played by Charles Martin Smith. He plays Toad trying to get with Candy Clark, who is the really sexy girl. So you have that.
He really did a great job, that Charles Martin Smith. He's had quite a career from that film.
He did, and unfortunately he died young.
Yes, that is a tragedy, isn't it?
He went on to other films like The Untouchables. And
he did that one film where he was out in nature.
Right, that was one of his last films, I think.
I thought that was an incredible stretch for him. He did a really nice job.
Right, and this is also one of those movies,
yes,
like Superbad, where you have this list of people that went on to other things with huge success often. Though Ron Howard realized he wasn't the greatest of actors and became a director. He's a much better director than actor. Sidney Williams went on to Laverne and Shirley. Paul LaMatt did a few films, but he never could quite connect with the audience quite like the others could. Mackenzie Phillips went on to One Day at a Time, and she also died, unfortunately, young.
Yeah, right.
Richard Dreyfuss went on to win an Oscar. His career had problems because he did have issues with drugs, but I mean, he did Jaws and Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And then, of course, Harrison Ford, who had just about given up acting and become a carpenter and was working as a carpenter. When they offered him this part, they offered him, I think, less than $485 a week.
Really?
But he was making $485 a week as a carpenter, and he had a family and everything. So why would he give up being a carpenter, you know, to make less money? Then they raised it $500, and he decided to do it. And the rest is history.
Yeah, a leap of faith sometimes.
Right.
It's a ballsy profession, that's for sure. You know,
right.
A lot of wonderful, charming people have not got their opportunities. But then on the other hand, that's what makes life interesting, I guess.
But the cast did cause some issues when it came to releasing the film.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Because none of them were famous.
No.
So they didn't have a star to sell the movie on. And in fact, they were going to release it to TV.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. In fact, Francis Ford Coppola offered at one point, because they were having problems over the editing with Universal, Coppola said, I'll buy this, sell it to me. And they didn't do it. And he regrets it to this very day because, of course, the movie made a fortune. They didn't think there was anything to sell it on. They didn't think there was anything there that they could market. But other studios started getting wind of this, and word of mouth was just great on this film. So they decided to open it with a limited release. And then the reaction was so good that they then opened it wider, and it became a really big hit.
Yeah, huge.
They did cut out three small scenes, which were later put back in by Lucas on a re-release. I can't remember all three, but one of them is when Charles Martin Smith runs into the salesman, tries to buy the car that he's driving.
Right, right. Did they make an American Graffiti 3 or just a 2?
Just the 2. Have you seen American Graffiti 2?
I did. I didn't enjoy it as much, but I did see it. It's been quite a while.
I saw it when it came out. If I saw it now, I might not like it. But when I saw it at the time, I thought it was underrated. Even though, yes, it's not as good as American Graffiti, and no one is ever going to make right. that argument with a sane mind. There was a lot I liked about it. The structure, each section is a different year, and each section focuses on a different character, and each section is a different film style.
Oh, yeah. It's been so long, I should probably revisit that. Yeah.
It got terrible reviews, but at the time I thought it was underrated.
Right.
One of the things that made it a hit, it was almost instant nostalgia. Not only was it nostalgia for 1962, it was like nostalgia for when you saw it. So not only was this movie nostalgia for 62, now it's sort of like I'm nostalgic for when I saw it.
I think when you connect with an emotion or a personal experience or something that touches you, yeah, it starts to spread like syrup, a little mushy.
Right. And one of the critics at the time said, maybe this tagline shouldn't be where were you in 62, but where were you in 72?
Mm, yeah. To think that it was only released in 73, right? So it was made in 72, which was only 10 years removed, you know?
Right.
You and I being a little bit older, 10 years is just a blink of an eye in a way. Yes. And yet pay homage to a prior generation just shows how much society really had advanced between the early 60s and the early 70s.
That's a good point. It was doubly nostalgic because 72 was very different from 62.
Yeah, exactly. That's my point, yeah.
1962 was sort of the end. I wouldn't say the end of innocence because I think that's always a bit over-exaggerated. America has always had problems. America has always been conflicted. But 62 was before we got into Vietnam. Kennedy is assassinated 1 year later, and then Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. The civil rights movement has started, but it really gets into gear after 62. We have the Summer of Love, not much longer after that. And then we have the rise of drug use. And it was such an immense change that it's hard for it not to be instant nostalgia.
Things were really cooking in that time frame, weren't they?
Yes. You know, we're talking about the way women were looked at in Superbad.
Right.
And to some degree, I think that's also true in American Graffiti, though I think there's more to the women in American Graffiti than in Superbad. But one of the things that people talked about at the time, and I noticed it too, was at the very end, there is the title card that says what happens to the character.
Where they end up going.
And it's almost a sock to the gut in a way, because two of them, their futures are not too great. The toad disappears in Vietnam, and the hot rodder, Paul LaMatt, John Milner, is hit by a drunk driver and died.
Yes.
But the women are not mentioned.
That's funny too, isn't it? I never noticed that.
I did at the time, and I wasn't the only one. Pauline Kael really let George Lucas have it for this, you know, accused him of being a chauvinist. The writers who can cats, they were incredulous that Lucas planned to only include the male characters. His reasoning was that if he mentioned the women, that meant adding another title card, which he felt would prolong the ending, but it still seemed very, very odd.
Yeah, he could have fixed that. I mean, there's ways to adjust the timing on stuff like that.
Right, and it does go back to the coming-of-age films. The vast majority of them are seen from straight white male perspectives. A lot of the reason being, that's who makes these films. Might never enter their heads to talk more about the women.
I see your point. I think that's starting to be addressed pretty forcefully in today's world. What do you think?
Well, I think everything's getting better from that perspective right now. And lately we have had things like The Diary of a Teenage Girl, Booksmart, and movies like that, where they're definitely showing things from a female perspective. But of course, the reason why is there are a lot more female directors out there. There are a lot more female producers and writers, and they want their stories told.
I've worked with several women directors here in the past few years. Anything I say from this point forward is going to be a generalization, but it's, for the most part, been a very good experience. Let me just leave it at that. I did a film with a woman director, Nora Gruber, and oh my God, that woman is, she should be working all the time, and she's not. There's another woman director I worked with on a film called The Suitcase that did well in Trifecta a couple of years ago, and Abby Damaris Corbin. She's going to work a lot in the future, I think, too, and there's a lot of talent out there, that's for sure. And
And we still have a ways to go. One of the, perhaps, things that is helping is that the studios only make a minority of the movies now. And now that anybody can make a movie, that makes it easier for people of diverse backgrounds to make their movies.
I was asked to consult the other day or to a contract that a gentleman director received. And it was basically an opportunity letter. A certain major studio that I won't name was apportioning $100 million to make 50 projects over the next couple of years. And they were garnering a list of prospective directors, mostly from the diverse categories. Mm-hmm. And there's money and there's motivation going into that. I've seen the actual paperwork. I know it's evolving.
Are you a big fan of George Lucas?
No, not really. How about you?
I think that George Lucas is a good storyteller.
Right.
I mean, the stories he tells are very interesting. I don't think he's a very good writer. Mm. And here he collaborated on the script with two other writers who probably are to be credited a lot for the success of the film. I know Star Wars is a classic. I love Star Wars. I love all three of them. I enjoy them very much, but they're not very well written. The characters are flat and bland, and the dialogue is laughably bad. I always loved Harrison Ford's comment to Lucas, you know, you can type this shit, but you can't say it.
Yeah, it's not my style of entertainment, but a lot of people love it, that's for sure.
Yes, and I do enjoy them. He's certainly not going to go up there with Stanley Kubrick or Martin Scorsese, or my favorite today is Tarantino and Mikhail Haneke. Mm. But yes, he's not a very good writer, is my main issue.
For me, the writing is the beginning and the end of the story. I love the way a good, charming actor can fill in the colors and riff around what he's been given, but if it's not a good story and if it's not compelling or charming, then... And it's an effort. And I spend enough effort in my day-to-day jobs. I don't need to do that with my entertainment.
Well, with that, here's some more information about the film. It was produced on a budget of $777,000. Mm-hmm. And it made $140 million. It was one of the most profitable films of all time. And upon being re-released, it just made a lot more. It was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Picture, but lost to The Sting. It also got nominations for Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Supporting Actress, and Best Film Editing. It won the Golden Globe for Best Motion Picture Musical or Comedy. Candy Clark was nominated for Supporting Actress at the Oscars. Yes. Cindy Williams was nominated for Best Actress in a Supporting Role at the BAFTAs. Lucas got a nomination from the Directors Guild of America, and the writers were, I think, just nominated by the Writers Guild of America for Best Original Screenplay. But it did win Best Screenplay from the New York Film Critics Circle Awards and the National Society of Film Critics. It did not win any Oscars. It was the only film nominated that year for Best Picture that didn't win anything. In 1995, the United States Library of Congress deemed the film culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant and selected it for preservation in the National Film Registry. When it was re-released and those three scenes that I said were edited were put back in, they made one more change, and that was in the final title card when it came to Toad, the Charles Martin Smith role. Well, they moved up his death to December. Otherwise, it would have contradicted what happens in American Graffiti. One of the difficulties Lucas had in getting producers interested is he wanted to use all this music, but music licensing is one of the most expensive aspects of a film, and they thought it would just be too expensive. And along with Easy Rider, American Graffiti was one of the first films to not use a traditional film score, but instead use a series of popular hit songs. The only major artist that you don't hear is Elvis Presley, because Colonel Tom Parker wanted a lot of money. The registration plate on Milner's Yellow Deuce Coupe is THX138, which is a reference to George Lucas's movie THX1138.
Yes.
And the 55 Chevy that Bob Falfa drives is the same 55 Chevy used in the movie Two-Lane Blacktop. And Bob Falfa is the Harrison Ford character. The cartoon movie poster was drawn by longtime Mad Magazine artist Mort Drucker, who also ended up doing the artwork for American Confetti, the parody of the film in the Mad's April 1974 issue. And this was the first credited screen appearance of Kathleen Quinlan. Before moving on, is there anything else you might want to add about Superbad or American Graffiti or both films together?
No, I think that someday Superbad might end up in a library somewhere. I think it merits it, but we'll see.
We'll see. I think it changed the way, or helped change the way, coming-of-age movies started being made. Well, with that, let's start closing out, and I asked you to choose a film or two to go with your choice that might interest our audience.
Can I be self-serving a little bit?
Yes, you can. You can be as self-serving as you want.
I did a film a few years ago. It won the Academy Award for Best Student Narrative, directed by Jeremy Clough. It's a short film called This Way Up. Clough, C-L-O-E is the director. I'd love people to see that. It's not a lot of people have seen it, and it's very good. I also did a film that they can see online now. It's a 3.5-minute film that I completed a few weeks ago for the Christmas season. Even though we're a few weeks past that now, if someone wants to tap in exmasfilm.com, a 3-minute look at Christmas in this season, and people might get a kick out of that.
Well, I'm going to go a little overboard with this and list some of the best coming-of-age films. I will start with the earlier ones, the ones that shaped my view of coming-of-age film. Of course, that's Rebel Without a Cause, Nicholas Ray's 1995 drama with James Dean, about a group of middle-class teens who are lost. Murmur of the Heart, Louis Malle's 1971 French film, about an upper-middle-class French teen discovering sex, and The 400 Blows, François Truffaut's 1959 French film, about an unwanted teen who finds himself drifting into a life of petty crime. More recently, I will recommend Something in the Air, Olivier Assayas's autobiographical 2012 French film about a teen struggle with love and the burgeoning revolution brought on by the Vietnam War. The Diary of a Teenage Girl, Marielle Heller's controversial 2015 film about a teen's discovery of sex as she has an affair with her mother's boyfriend. And The Perks of Being a Wallflower, Stephen Chbosky's 2012 adaptation of his own book about an introverted teen starting high school after having attempted suicide and the outsider teens who come to support. So what is next? What should we be looking for? What's in the future for you?
Well, I just continue to field opportunities. We have some animation features that are coming out this summer. One that I'd like for everyone to see is called Infinity Pool. Play several of the characters in that. That's the thing that's the most immediate.
Great. As for me, I'll go through my usual litany.
All right.
I'm a screenwriter and script consultant, so I have a Howard Kasner Facebook screenplay consultation page. I have a blog called Rantings and Ravings, where I talk about issues concerning film and screenwriting. I've published 2 books of short stories, The Starving Artist and Other Stories, The Five Corporations, and One True Religion. These are supernatural, sci-fi, and horror stories, and you can find those on Amazon. Also on Amazon, I have published the second edition of a screenwriting book, More Rantings and Ravings of a Screenplay Reader, and I am an amateur photographer, and you can find those on Instagram. The previous podcast was with film enthusiast and podcaster of Cinema Recall, Laverne, where we discussed Go and 71 Fragments of a Chronicle of Chance, 2 films about 3 groups of disparate people whose stories interact during shocking acts of violence. The next episode will be with writer-director, actor Robert Brody, where we will discuss Dead Calm and Knife in the Water, 2 films about a couple and a stranger they pick up who end up in conflict while on a boat and cut off from the outside world. Well, with that, Charlie, I want to thank you very much for being a guest on my show.
I'm honored to have the opportunity, and I wish you the best of luck, Howard, and thank you very much. Thank you.